The cessation of all sound roused Truk, and he groaned as he tried to move. The sand was a stifling weight upon him. It seemed to crush in his ribs and force the breath from his lungs. Nevertheless, he knew that the spot Ishtar had chosen for them to ride out the storm was, either by chance or design, a good one. In any other place they might have been buried for ever. Here, he'd been able to keep close to the surface of the earth. In the past days, as the layers of blown sand had built up over him, and the weight had become unbearable, he'd managed to wriggle free, leaving only enough covering him to protect him from the full abrasive force of the Hamsin. Now he struggled up towards the light and air like a diver coming up from the depths of a deep pool. As he swam up laboriously through the sand, his damaged shoulder was a burning agony. He struggled on until his head, still swathed in folds of cloth, broke free. He unwrapped it and blinked about him in the dazzling light. The wind had passed, but the air was luminous with fine particles of suspended dust. He rested like that for a while, until the pain in his shoulder abated a little. Then he pushed aside the layer of sand that still covered his lower body, and tried to call out, "Ishtar, where are you?" But his voice was a formless croak. He turned his head slowly and saw the mead, sitting near him, his back to the rocky cliff face. He looked like an exhumed corpse that had been dead for days. Then Ishtar opened his one good eye.
"Water!"
Truk's voice was only just intelligible, but the mead shook his head. "So we've survived the storm just to die in the same grave," Truk tried to say, but no sound came out from his ravaged throat and mouth. He lay for a while longer, and felt any instinct to survive being extinguished under the slow seep of exhaustion and resignation. It would be so much easier just to close his eyes and drift off to sleep, never to wake again. That thought spurred him, and he forced open his crusted eyelids, felt the grit under the lids scraping in his eyeballs.
"Water!" he said. "Find water!"
Using the cliffside as a support, he lurched to his feet and stood there swaying, hugging his useless arm to his chest. Ishtar watched him, his one blind eye like that of a reptile or a corpse. Truk started forward drunkenly, bumping into the cliff at every few paces he took, making his way along the base of the rock until he could look out over the desert. The dunes were pristine and unblemished, as voluptuously curved as the body of a lovely young girl. There was no trace of men or vehicles. His fighting divisions, the finest in all Egypt, had vanished without trace. He tried to lick his lips, but there was no spittle in his chalky mouth. He felt his legs give way under him, and he knew that if he went down he would never rise again. Using the wall of stone as a support, he tottered on, not knowing where he was going, and with no thought in his head but to go on. Then he heard human voices, and he knew he was hallucinating. There was silence again. He went a few steps further, stopped, and listened. The voices came again. This time they were closer and clearer. He felt unexpected strength flow back into his body, but when he tried to call out, no sound came from his parched throat. There was silence once more. The voices had ceased. He started forward again, then stopped suddenly. A woman's voice. No mistaking it. A sweet, clear voice. Mintaka. A name formed silently on his swollen lips. Then another voice, this time a man's. He could not make out the words or recognize the speaker. But if he was with Mintaka, he must be one of the fugitives Truk had been pursuing. The enemy. Truk looked down at himself. His sword belt was gone, and his weapons with it. He was unarmed, dressed only in his tunic, which had so much sand in the weave that it chafed his skin like a hair shirt. He looked round him for a weapon, a stick or a stone. There was nothing. The scree had been covered by sand. He stood undecided, and the voices came again. Mintaka and the man were in a gully among the rocks. While he hesitated, he heard the sand crunching like salt crystals under someone's feet. That person was coming down the gully towards where Trock stood. Trock shrank back against the stone wall, and the man emerged from the mouth of the gully 20 paces from where Trock hid. The stranger set off with a determined stride into the dunes. He was strongly familiar, but recognition eluded Trock until the man turned and called back towards the gully. "Do not tax yourself unduly, Mintaka. You've come through a trying ordeal." Then he walked on. Trock gaped after him. "He's dead," he thought. "It cannot be him. The message from Naja was clear." He considered the possibility that a djinn or some evil spirit was impersonating the young pharaoh Nefaseti as he watched the young man go out into the desert. Then, through eyes bleary with sand, he saw him join 3 others, among them the unmistakable figure of the warlock, who, Trock realized, must be responsible in some strange and miraculous way for the resurrection of Nefaseti. But now he had neither the time nor the inclination to ponder this further. There was only one thought in his mind, and that was water. As stealthily as he could, he crept forward into the gully where he'd heard Mintaka's voice and peered round the corner of the cliff. He did not recognize her at first. She was as bedraggled as a peasant. Her hair and her tattered tunic were stiff with sand, and her eyes were sunken and bloodshot. She was kneeling at the head of one of the small herd of horses, holding a water bucket for it to drink. Water was the only thing Trock could think about. He could smell it, and his whole body craved it. He staggered towards Mintaka. Her back was turned to him, and the soft sand covered the sound of his approach. She was not aware of him until he seized her arm. She turned, saw him, and screamed. He snatched the bucket from her hands and knocked her down. As his arm was useless, he knelt on the small of her back to pin her down while he drank from the bucket. He swallowed huge gulps, gurgled and belched, then drank some more. Mintaka was wriggling under him and screaming, "Nefa! Taita, help me!" He belched again, pushed her face into the sand to silence her, and swallowed the last drops from the bucket. He looked round him, still crouching over her like a lion on its kill. He saw the water skin against the wall of the gully, and the javelins and swords stacked beside it. He stood up quickly and started towards them. Instantly Mintaka tried to jump to her feet, but he kicked her down again.
"None of that, you bitch!"
He croaked and seized a handful of her thick, sand-drenched hair. He dragged her after him through the sand until he reached the water skin. Then he had to drop her. He placed one huge, sandaled foot on her back again, reached for the water-skin, and held it between his knees while he unfastened the wooden stopper. He lifted the nozzle to his lips and let the warm, brackish liquid flow down his throat. Although she was face down in the sand, Mintaka realized that Trock was engrossed in his craving for water. She must act before he'd satisfied it, and turned his full attention on her. She knew that he'd suffered more humiliation than he could bear, and that he'd kill her now rather than let her escape him again. Desperately she reached out to the bundle of weapons stacked against the rock. Her fingers closed round the shaft of a javelin. Trock was still drinking with his head thrown back, but he felt her movement and lowered the water skin just as Mintaka twisted to stab up at his belly and groin with the short but deadly weapon. However, the blow was aimed from her prone position under him and lacked force. Trock saw the bright bronze point flash, and with a startled exclamation jumped back to avoid it.
"You treacherous little slut!"
He dropped the water skin and lunged for her. But the moment his weight was off her, Mintaka jumped up. She tried to slip past him and run out of the gully into the open desert, but he cut her off and reached for her with his long arm. He caught the hem of her tunic, but she leapt aside. The linen tore in his fingers, and she twisted away from him. But he still had her trapped in the gully. He lumbered after her, but she ran to the cliff wall and started to scale it, lithe and quick as a cat. Before he could catch her, she was out of his reach. She went up swiftly, and he could not hope to follow her. He picked up the javelin she had dropped and hurled it up at her, but he was using his left hand, and there was little power in the throw. Mintaka ducked as the javelin flew over her head and struck the rock in front of her face. She climbed faster, driven by fear. Trok staggered to where the other weapons were stacked and grabbed another javelin. He threw again. It missed her by a hand's width. Trok grunted with fury and frustration and snatched a third javelin. But at that moment Mintaka reached a ledge in the cliff and crawled over it out of his sight. She lay there, pressing herself against the rock. She heard him raving and swearing at her. Even in her distress she was sickened by the filthy words he sent after her. Then another javelin flashed over where she lay and clattered against the rock face above her. It dropped back onto the ledge, and she grabbed it before it could fall back to the gully floor. She peered over the edge of the ledge, ready to duck back. Trok was staring up at her uncertainly, his injured arm dangling at his side. When her head appeared, his face contorted with rage and the pains of his injury, and he started forward as if to climb up to her. She showed him the point of the javelin. "Yes, come up," she hissed at him. "Let me stick this in your great hog belly." He stopped. He would have to climb and defend himself with only one arm. He saw that her threat was real. While he hesitated, Mintaka began to scream again, "Nefer, Daita, Hilto, help me!" A voice echoed off the cliff and rang down the gully. He looked about him nervously, as if expecting to see a rush of armed enemies coming at him. Suddenly he reached a decision. He picked up the water-skin and slung it over his shoulder.
"Do not think you can evade me forever. One day I will sample all the delights of your body, and afterwards I'll give you as a plaything to my troopers," he shouted up at her.
Then he tried to mount the mare, but she was still too weak to support his bulk, and collapsed under him. Trok hauled himself to his feet and lumbered away down the gully. Mintaka feared that his withdrawal might be a trick. She dared not descend from her perch on the cliff. She screamed wildly, "Nefer, help me!" She was still screaming when Nefer came racing back to her down the rocky gully, a sword in his hand, Hilto and Merin close behind him.
"What is it?"
Nefer demanded as she slid down the cliff into his arms.
"Trok!"
she sobbed with relief to feel him now holding her safely.
"Trok is alive. He was here."
She blurted out an account of what had happened, but before she'd ended, Nefer was giving orders to the others to arm themselves and prepare to go after Trok.